I'm going to take a few moments, perhaps more moments than my colleagues did, to share my thoughts about the motion, but also just some maybe personal reflection about the process that we've gone through over the last a little over a year. As we went through the evidentiary hearing this summer, that hearing took me personally back to 1981, and I want to explain why that happened. I was a senior in high school that year, and my VOAG teachers asked me or encouraged me to enter the FFA's public speaking contest. That was kind of a new thing for me. And so I picked a topic, I researched it thoroughly, I wrote the speech, I was prepared for all the questions. The topic that I chose was groundwater contamination. A lot of what we heard in the evidentiary hearing this summer took me back to that research and that speech that I gave. And I share that only because I want you all to know that water contamination and water quality are a big deal to me, and it has been for a long, long time. It's not something that I take lightly or something that I dismiss. One of the other things that I try to do as I work through cases is I like to try to figure out where are people coming from. And I will tell you that, you know, one of the things that maybe mystified me or had me puzzled from the very beginning was the vehemence of the opposition to this pipeline from our tribal members in South Dakota. You know, when Mr. Harder and Mr. Siemens come up and they're opposed, I can get that because I come from a rancher background just like they do. But with our Native American friends, that had me maybe a little bit puzzled. Until we received on July 19th, a comment, one of the comments in this docket, a public comment, and we received hundreds of public comments. But this one really spoke to me, and it was from Deborah Whiteplume of Manderson. And it spoke to me in a powerful way that I think deserves my reading, just a portion of it, because it helped to answer for me, I think, what a lot of our tribal members are feeling. And she said in her email, "The Lakota worldview and the American worldview about land and water are different, as is our worldview about time and space. The American worldview, through its institutions and policies and laws and regulations, say that elected officials and appointed officials have the final decision on what happens in our shared space. To clarify this by the word, quote, our, unquote, I'm referring to the Lakota and the Americans and the elected appointed officials and the rest of us. In the Lakota worldview, everyone has a say. A collective decision is made by consensus. There is no hierarchy of one person being more important than another. All people are important and have a right to their say. In my view, the space and distance between where I live and where TransCanada Inc. wants to put its KXL tar sands pipeline is too close. Although the place where I lay my head to rest at night, where I rise each morning to live a life I'm thankful for, and the pipeline route through Mission, South Dakota, or Murdo, South Dakota, or Laura Brule, South Dakota, or Faith, South Dakota, may be hundreds of miles, but to me, the route is just right there. This whole area is my home. The KXL proposed route you are considering would not only be insanely located over the Ogallala Aquifer, it would also recklessly cross many surface waters, including the Missouri River and the Cheyenne River. All of this is sacred water. We say, Mini Wikizani, through water there is life. Without water, there is no life. And she goes on to say that water is part of all Lakota ceremonies. We honor and respect water. And perhaps Deborah's right. We have a different worldview. And I appreciate her taking the time to explain to me in a way that I could understand where our Native American friends are coming from in this docket. I can't change the fact we have different worldviews, but I appreciate knowing about that worldview. The other thing that I need to comment on was from the opening statement of Dallas Goldtooth. And in his opening statement at the evidentiary hearing, Dallas talked about how he thought we as commissioners should go about making our decision. And his comments, I thought, were very striking, and a very small portion, I think, deserve reading. And I'm going to read from the transcript, where Mr. Goldtooth says, "If you go back in history of this great country, in some instances, if we stuck strictly to the rules of law, we probably would have been in some tough situations. Whether it's Jim Crow laws or whatever it may be down in the South, we have to allow ourselves to be influenced by our emotion and the greater context of our emotions as human beings. I encourage each and every one of you to push to that level." I think that comment from Mr. Goldtooth bears addressing, and I think everyone needs to understand that on January 8th of 2013, I stood in this building and I took an oath of office to uphold the laws of the state of South Dakota. It was not an oath that directed me to make decisions based upon emotion. I was directed by that oath, and I am bound by that oath to make my decisions based upon the facts and the law as has been established through this proceeding. So let's for a moment talk about that law. It's acknowledged by everyone that Keystone has the burden of proving that they complied with SDCL 49-41B-27. Pretty simple statute. All of us probably have it memorized, but it says in part, quote, "The utility must certify to the Public Utilities Commission that such facility continues to meet the conditions upon which the permit was issued," unquote. On September 15th, 2014, a certification was received by the PUC, signed by Corey Goulet on behalf of TransCanada. The requirement to certify was met with that filing. Now, previously I served this state as Secretary of State, and in that capacity I worked with certifications all the time. This is not a new concept to me whatsoever. The certification that came in was accompanied by a petition asking that the certification be accepted. Along with that petition was Appendix C, which we've come to know as the Tracking Table of Changes. The petition states that the changes outlined in the tracking table don't prevent TransCanada from meeting the permit conditions. Throughout this proceeding, the commissioners have urged the opponents to show us the specific conditions that could no longer be met. Very simply, prove to us that the certification was not valid. Indeed, and I went back and I read through the transcript of the close of the evidentiary hearing, and Commissioner Hansen and I nearly begged the opponents, in your final briefs, identify for us specific conditions that could not be met. And frankly, as I read through those briefs, there's only one that I thought attempted to do that, and that was Gary Doerr. He pointed to a specific condition and tried to make his case that the company couldn't comply with that. Now, at the end of the day, I think his argument fell short, but he tried. Very simply, SDCL 49-41B-27 does not require a rehashing of the requirements for the initial permit under 49-41B-22. And if there's been a very, what I think, unfortunate part of this whole proceeding is that the opponents spent their time and energy trying to litigate Section 22 instead of 27, which is the one that is before us. So, long-winded speech, what is my conclusion? My conclusion is that nothing presented by the opponents proves that the permit conditions cannot continue to be met even with the circumstances found in the tracking table of changes. As we know, one of the conditions, one of the absolute requirements, is obtaining a presidential permit. We all know that's not going to happen in the next 12 months. What we don't know is what will happen after that point in time. There remains the possibility that a presidential permit can be obtained, and therefore that is not a reason to find the certification invalid. What we do know is that should this motion pass, the permit will remain conditionally valid. And so with that, I intend to support the motion.